I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. When Banneker Charter Academy closed in July, hundreds of Metro students were left stranded, and their parents left to get them enrolled elsewhere for school just weeks before it was set to begin. The closing wasn't a huge surprise, but it got people thinking about a school's responsibility and accountability to the communities they serve. Today, area charter school insiders take that issue up. Then we meet a Kansas City high schooler whose spoken word poetry earned her a ticket to an international competition in Houston. We'll ask about her team's performance in Texas and her inspiration here at home. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Just a few weeks before school starts again, the local charter school Benjamin Banneker Charter Academy of Technology announced that it will be closing its doors. With such little time left before classes start, the news left parents scrambling to find another option. All this had us wondering about the oversight of charters and this relationship between the schools have to their sponsors and the families that send their kids to them. With us to talk about this aspect of charter schools are Douglas Thaman. He's executive director of the Missouri Charter Public Schools Association. Doug, nice to have you back. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
Diane Charity is also here. She's a navigator with Show Me KC Schools that helps Kansas City parents find the right school for their children. Diane, nice to have you too. Welcome.
Good morning and thank you.
Doug, help me here. How can it be that a charter school here would shut down just weeks before classes begin when its sponsor announced last October that it wouldn't renew its contract?
Well, if you look back at the course of events that took place, the sponsor did notify the school back in October that they were not going to renew their contract. And it's that legal contract that they have and holds the school responsible for how they do academically. The school and the board of that school made the determination to file for an injunction in order to attempt to stay open. And it was that injunction and the process that happened in the courts that seems to have eaten up a lot of time that led us to where we are this summer and needing to make sure we have these students enrolled in new schools and ready to start the year.
But still, to announce just weeks before classes begin, pretty awkward and a minimum here, and I'm not even one of the parents.
Yeah, I don't disagree with that. And we, as in any situation, we rely on adults to make decisions that are in the best interest of students. And so although there appeared to be a legal situation occurring and disagreement between a sponsor and a school and the state, during that entire time, we really count on adults to make decisions in the best interest of kids and to let families know, hey, here's what's going on, and encourage them to do what's right for their children. We do know that some families, even back in February, were making the decision to go ahead and move to a new school.
They saw the writing on the wall.
They saw the writing on the wall.
So what is a charter school, Doug, required to do in a case like this? I mean, who's in charge of making sure that parents are informed of the status of any charter school?
The way the law reads, it's actually a joint responsibility between the sponsor of the school and the school itself. Everybody that works within a charter school understands that when a school opens, they have a legal commitment to meet their academic performance goals. And if that doesn't happen over a period of time, they understand that it is the decision of the sponsor whether or not to keep that school open. And when the sponsor makes that decision, you know, it's not that people are bad people or they didn't work their best to try and help those students,
right,
but they need to live up to the commitment that they made back when the school was open, which is if we can't meet these goals, if we can't provide this academic instruction and students are not moving forward academically, that we will close.
You know, Diane Charity, again, you're a navigator. You help parents find the right choice for their kids. What do we know about how the parents have done at Benjamin Banneker Charter Academy of Technology? Have they found new schools for their kids, or are some still looking here?
Many of them have. The majority have found new schools. The challenges with the ones, the few that haven't. So when I came on in June, I actually sent out an email blast to all the parents, whether we knew that they had found a school or not, just to check with them to say, have you found that school? Do you still need help?
What did you find out?
Well, I found out that most people wrote me back and said, yes, I found a school, and they even gave me the name of the school. But there were a few that said, no, I haven't found anything yet. And those were the ones that I reached out to try to help them to make that decision and find out what they're going to do.
When you say a few, Diane, you're talking about roughly how many?
So far, maybe about five or six.
Oh, just a handful.
Yes, just a handful.
This school had a lot of kids in it.
Had a lot of kids in it. And but those parents that went ahead and responded to our school fair that we held with them in January and late February, UCM had asked us to do two school fairs. We did one right there at Banneker, and many of the parents got that information, and we got some contact information from them.
So you had a school fair that was allowing parents to look at options at that point right at the school that was very much in the spotlight here.
Yes, sir. Uh-huh.
Okay.
And total, it was about 60 parents that actually signed up to find out more about other schools. And out of those 60, those are the ones that I reached out to in the last month or, 3 weeks or so. And those are the ones I've responded to. Our challenge has been we don't have a list of all the parents or their contact information. So those that...
Why not?
Well, we don't... Show Me Casey Schools wouldn't have a list. The school would have a list.
Did the school provide you one?
No.
Why not?
That's what we would love to find out, why they wouldn't. I think because they thought that they were going to stay open.
Because you're there to help kids find new homes,
right.
And you weren't allowed to make the connections you need to make there.
That's right. Not for the entire school, everyone in the school. So
yeah. We
just used the ones that we collected when we did our school fairs.
Doug, why wouldn't the charter school provide a list to the navigators here to help parents find new homes for their kids, new school homes for their kids?
Well, again, we would hope they would. And we made a similar request through the school's legal counsel to have a list of the families sent to us so that we could help and encourage them to enroll in new schools and could provide that information to Show Me Casey Schools. Our understanding is they made the decision not to do that, and I think you'd have to ask the school and their legal counsel why, but we really believe everybody needs to make decisions in the best interest of kids, which is they should provide that information, and let's make sure kids are in schools.
Now, I want to go back to this notion of the school closing when it did, Doug. When it comes to the contract between a charter and its sponsor, is an exit plan a requirement or even recommended as a best practice here? Because Central Missouri, the school sponsor, announced last October it wouldn't renew the contract. Banneker waited until March to file an injunction to stop closure. And then when it couldn't find another sponsor, it threw in the towel. A public school principal and staff couldn't do anything like that. So why can't a charter?
Well, an exit plan is required. It's required. We had that in statute back in 2015 that it needed to be part of the legal contract. It also has to be part of their application when they are approved to open, that there are procedures in place for closure. It's interesting. If you look at other situations, we had a school in St. Louis that closed and recently, and the board of that school, although they had really put a lot of effort into providing a great education to the students just were not making the academic gains. The board made the decision to work with the sponsor. They surrendered their charter. And then the board, the school leadership, and the sponsor worked together and made sure every one of those children were in a new school and ready for the new school year. that's how this process should work. That's how everybody should behave.
But why is it up to the charter school itself? Why doesn't your organization step in when a school is underperforming and say, you guys have got to close shop and figure something else out?
Well, our organization is a nonprofit membership support organization. Now,
how about the state itself?
You have the state, you have the sponsor. So it's the sponsor's responsibility to step in. In this case, University of Central Missouri appears to have done that. It's the responsibility of the state to make sure that sponsors are carrying forward with their responsibilities. And that we believe that the state has done that with the University of Central Missouri, but they need to continue to evaluate sponsors and make sure they're executing their practices appropriately.
You know, I can't help but wonder if the state waited too long to move on Benjamin Banneker Charter. You know, just to put this all into context, state records show that Banneker's overall score was 71% in 2014. This is the way the state calculates these things. It dropped to a provisional accreditation level of 60% in 2015. It dropped again in 2016 to 46.9%, whereas KC Public Schools were at 70% that year. In 2017, just 22% of Banneker students were at or above grade level in English language arts. 12% were at or above grade level in math. How did the school remain open?
That's a great question. Like, and 5 years ago, when the contract for this particular school was renewed, there were questions around, is that the appropriate decision to be made? Should the school be renewed? And that's a decision that we really believe needs to be evaluated. And one of the reasons why we were really pleased to hear from the state board at their last meeting, the state board president even referenced the importance of really making sure the state has the proper way in place to determine whether or not a charter school is performing academically.
Right.
As opposed to ways that have been in practice for a long time now of comparing them to an entire school district, things that just don't make sense. But let's make sure we have the right method, the right metrics that we're looking at so that the best decisions can be made. Because we don't want this kind of a situation to happen again.
We're talking about the closing of Benjamin Banneker Charter Academy of Technology. It's located at 6401 Rock Hill Road. Diane Charity, I'm wondering, as a navigator who helps connect parents and their children to the right schools for them, what were you recommending about Benjamin Banneker Charter as you went through recent years and recent months, given those numbers I just read off here?
Well, what we have done and what I've done as a navigator is allow that parent to go to a website that we have. On that website, it's a plethora of information about any school. Matter of fact, it's such a neat website that you can even compare schools with all their features, all the good things about it, all the things that you need for your child right there on the website.
I can't help but wonder if attendance at Benjamin Banneker was dropping because of those test scores.
Do
you know?
I don't know if that's why it happened, but knowing that we are able to go ahead and provide that information for the parents to make that good decision, and we're still in that process. I want to just say right now, right here, right now, is that if anybody needs help still, we're right here to serve them. I'll come to them. I'll meet with them. If they don't have a computer, I've got one they can use, and a book.
Our phone number here, 816-81, that's my cell phone. 816-235-2888 is our number here at UpToDate. 816-235-2888. Or you can tweet us at @KCURUpToDate. Doug, again, with the Missouri Charter Public School Association, explain to us again, why does a charter school even need a sponsor? Why is the system set up the way it is?
Well, as I said earlier, Steve, a charter school is a public school with a contract. And that contract with a sponsor outlines exactly how that school needs to perform. It talks about how the school needs to perform academically, how it needs to perform financially, and about the governance and operation of the school. If the school, it's the responsibility of that sponsor then to monitor that contract and monitor the performance of the school. and to make decisions about whether that contract should be renewed after a five-year period.
How many charter schools have actually been forced to close during the history of Missouri charter schools?
You know, during the history of the charter schools, so we're talking back into the late 90s, there have been about, I'd say it's about 22% of the charter schools that have opened have closed. And, you know, a lot of
22%.
22%, right. Now, keeping in mind, you only have charter schools in two cities in the state right now, and it's a small number. But that has improved over time as we have improved the accountability over time.
How many charter schools do we have in the state of Missouri right now?
In the state of Missouri, you have about 40 charter school contracts, LEAs, and then you have some of those schools have one building, some have two or three buildings. But all in all, in Kansas City alone, it's about 49% of the student population, public school student population, attends charter schools.
And how many do we have in Kansas City?
We have 22.
Okay, 22. And I sit on the editorial board of The Star, which last November questioned whether the city has too many charters. Do you think we have too many charters, Diane?
Being sector agnostic, I don't think we have too many, but our public schools are gaining and academically and as well as the charters and the private and public, all the schools are gaining in their ability to teach our kids. So I don't think it's too many.
Is the number 22 considered high for a city, Doug, a city our size?
It's considered a little above average. Steve, it kind of depends on how you look at it. If you look at the number of seats in schools for Kansas City, one might say, well, you know, there's an awful lot of public school buildings with open seats. But if you look at the number of quality seats, seats where students are making academic gains, one would say, well, you know, at different levels, there's a need for more. It also can be looked at in certain parts of the community. There are still communities within Kansas City where there's not a performing public school.
Right. Right.
And so that community would say, hey, we really do need a school.
Now, our editorial, Doug, also noted that the dearth of charter schools east of Highway 71 raises questions about which children are being left out of this public school option. Are charters placed according to need within a city, or who determines where they're located?
Well, that has changed over time as well. You know, the idea is you want to, part of looking at where a charter school should be located has to be where there is need and where the school can demonstrate there's a demand. Over time,
is there less demand east of Highway 71 in Kansas City?
There is not less demand, but there are fewer facilities, and facilities have become a real problem because it's very hard for a charter school to find a building and to be able to afford a building.
I thought there were all kinds of abandoned Kansas City public schools on the east side of town.
Well, during the course of history, the Kansas City public schools have had different opinions about willingness to either lease or sell those buildings. And a lot of those buildings now are in such disrepair because they've been shuttered for so long that it's not affordable to be able to bring those buildings back to life.
So you're saying there are real roadblocks to establishing charters east of 71?
There are real roadblocks, and we're continuing to try and move past that because that's where we're seeing a demand.
There's also questions about diversity or a lack thereof. Academy Lafayette once had a high percentage of students of color, and 9 out of 10 students served by the district is a student of color. But now Academy Lafayette is one of the whitest public schools in Kansas City. How did that happen?
Yeah, what you see happen is that a school does very well, and so it starts to attract a lot of different families. And the positive side to that is you have families moving back into Kansas City. The challenging side to that is, does that start to displace other students? And so we were really thrilled that this year the state passed an addition to the charter school laws that allows a school to establish a preference within their enrollment lottery for students who are considered high risk, because that definition of high risk really will allow a lot of diversity and a lot of underserved families to have seats and maintain seats in these schools.
Is that new law having an impact? Is it changing things?
It just went into effect in August, but we have schools who have jumped right on that and are revising their charters and their contracts with their sponsors because they want to have that that preference.
Well, we'll come back and visit about that sometime soon. That'd be great. I want to thank our guest today, Doug Thaman, Executive Director of the Missouri Charter Public School Association, Diane Charity, a navigator with Show Me KC Schools. Thank you very much. Sure appreciate it.
Thank you, Steve.
Time for a break. When we come back, we'll talk with some championship slam poetry students. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. Join us tomorrow as we explore the history of the Kansas City chapter of the Black Panthers. The group established a presence here less than a year after deadly riots back in the late 1960s. That's tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, a group of spoken word poets from Kansas City Public School District's Lincoln Prep High School have competed and ranked in a national youth poetry festival. In fact, the Lincoln poets placed in the top 10 last month out of 50 teams competing in the international youth poetry festival Brave New Voices that was held in Houston, Texas. Earlier this year, these scholars won the local Louder Than a Bomb KC High School Slam Poetry Contest, sponsored by Kansas City's American Jazz Museum, the KC Word Shop, and the Black Archives of Mid-America. What are we talking about exactly here? Well, Lincoln Prep sophomore is about to show us. This is Abby Espino Salazar.
Hi.
Hi. Good morning.
Good morning. It's nice to see everybody.
Can you give us an example?
Yeah. Okay. So this one is about detained children.
Okay.
So I just got inspired by that. Shame, shame, shame. I don't want to go to Mexico no more, more, more. There's a big fat policeman at the door, door, door. And doesn't he know that to send me back is to sign my death certificate and claim me a corpse? I'm sorry that we did it the white way instead of the right way, but how ironic. The thieves convicting us of grand larceny when all we wanted was that bittersweet freedom you preach, and now look at us. Caged like animals. We got dreams too, America. There's an unspoken war where to be different is to be slaughtered, and everyone you know becomes unsolved homicides. So we came here seeking refuge. And you stole more than we had to offer. Me robaste de mi dignidad y lo estás negando. Politicians still have the nerve to say, close your eyes. It only exists if you let it. So here I stand to say, open your eyes. It only exists if you let it. Concentration camps only take place when people are too afraid to start riots and risk their freedom for the liberty of others. Pero todavía niños están en jaulas cantando esta rima de, and I don't want to go to Mexico no more, more, more. Y qué vergüenza.
Huh. I think that's worth a round of applause, don't you? That's pretty good. What was the inspiration for that piece?
I actually was watching a video about the femicides that's happening in like all of the native Spanish-speaking countries.
Yeah.
And it just affected me that we're still treating immigrants as they're like just bad human beings whenever they're already going through all this other stuff. So it just inspired me to make this poem.
Abby, what draws you to this kind of poetry? What is it?
I think it's the fact that young people aren't really given a voice most time.
And this gives them a voice.
Yeah, this really gave me an outlet to be able to speak about these things and to be heard and to be treated like an adult whenever I want to talk about certain things like this.
Why does slam poetry or spoken word poetry, is it the same thing, by the way?
To me, yes, but there have been times where I've performed and it's felt different because I'm not competing. So competition and just performing is different.
Now, I'm wondering, why does this kind of poetry give you that voice? Do people pay more attention to you when you're performing or what?
Yeah, people definitely pay more attention whenever you're doing things on stage to like kind of demand their attention. And it's just whenever you can play with words and make it sound like beautiful, people get drawn to that. And people see the ugly things that we're talking about in such a beautiful way. And that sparks a conversation.
You know, how did you feel about your team's performance, your Lincoln Prep's performance in Houston last month? Did you know, did it feel good as you went about the competition?
It felt amazing. And like the competition, it didn't really feel like a competition. Like everybody there was so friendly and the environment was just so loving.
Supportive and...
Yeah, all of the poets were like rooting for each other. And so whenever we performed, I was like, well, even if we don't get very far, then I'm proud of my team and I'm happy that we did this much.
And you finished in the top 10 of 50 teams.
Yeah, I'm very proud of us.
That's pretty darn good. Yeah. Well, let me also introduce this morning two others from Lincoln Prep. Joyce Hernandez, she's the Lincoln High team instructor and an English teacher. congratulations on your team's performance.
Thank you. They make me look very good.
Did you have a feeling during the performance that this thing was working, that you guys were going to finish pretty well?
This is our second year competing at Brave New Voices.
Yeah.
I thought it very unlikely that our team would return. We competed in San Francisco last year, and we were able to attend Houston this year. And every year it seems like they are hungrier and hungrier to share their stories and to let the world know that, you know, they're amazing writers and performers.
Why weren't you sure you'd be able to go to the competition this year? Just budget stuff?
I'm a realist, you know. We were competing locally against almost 2 dozen other teams. And
in order to go, you had to finish.
Correct. You had to be first.
You had to be first.
You had to be first locally.
And that's the competition that the
yes.
American Jazz Museum was involved
Correct.
With.
Correct.
Oh, I got it. Okay. Also here is Christian Foster. She's a principal at Lincoln Prep. Christian, nice to have you.
Good morning. Thank you.
You know, why is this kind of poetry so helpful for your students? Well, why do you encourage this kind of work?
Exactly for the reasons that Abby just said, as far as self-expression, and it engages students in things going on in our community and society in a different way. It's also an extension and an important piece of the arts that we support both as Lincoln College Prep and our entire school district, and we recognize the role that the arts play in our students' lives, and we are just very proud of their performance.
What you're saying to me is the arts still have a place in students' lives, because all you hear these days is that the arts aren't being taught much in high schools like yours.
We do hear that, but I would say that what's going on in our city and just broader community would indicate that the opposite has actually taken place. We have packed art classes from graphic design, photography. We have advanced international baccalaureate art programs at our school and in other schools throughout the district. And I think that our poetry group is a testament that we need to continue to further support the arts.
You're saying these classes are packed?
Packed. Yes, and on the students. We can't even give seats to all the students who want to take the classes. That's
you know, there's something else I wanted to ask about, Joyce, this notion that arts education and slam poetry like what Abby just performed helps with something else, and what that other thing is trauma.
Mm-hmm.
Explain that to me. What are we talking about here?
We were exposed to this amazing opportunity, and the students get to choose the prompts, the topics that they want to select. And what we've noticed that within all the teams, their communities, they're talking about some serious subjects. They're talking about gun violence. They're talking about racism. We had students in the international competition from the Pine Ridge Reservation and, you know, Trinidad and other communities. And they're able to share their personal stories. And oftentimes those personal stories include those conflicts. It's an opportunity for young people to kind of share that, you know, these experiences are universal.
And to what extent, Abby, does sharing and writing about these things help kids deal with this kind of trauma in their lives?
Well, like also writing, but like I remember I got really nervous one time about performing one of my personal pieces, and my poetry coach was talking to me and she said, somebody in the crowd needs to hear this. So just listening to poetry and understanding that somebody else is going through the same things that you're going through, and being able to have this outlet and tell them, if you can write, like, you can write and you can do this too, and it kind of relieves you. Like, I feel so much more free whenever I step off stage knowing that my story is heard.
What kind of trauma have you gone through in your life that you've wanted to talk about in your poetry?
Well, I've gone through, I don't want to say I've gone through a lot, I'm very fortunate, but I have gone through some stuff, and I have dealt with the gun violence in Kansas City, and also being, like, a minority, and having, like, everything going on right now with administration and just everything. I don't want to get too much into depth with that, but I am hurting because a lot of my people are hurting and my race is hurting. So if I have an outlet to speak about that, then I'm going to take full advantage of that.
You know, I'm wondering about gun violence. You know, there's a whole segment of our audience that's an absolutely foreign concept to. They don't deal with gun violence on a regular basis. To what extent do you deal with gun violence, and your classmates for that matter?
Well, gun violence is surrounded, like, all around us. I grew up here in Kansas City, and I actually lost my father when I was 9 years old to gun violence. So it's something that we see on a daily basis. And so many kids at Lincoln and everywhere, we struggle with this, and it is an ongoing thing that we have to talk about, because people get uncomfortable to talk about it. But it happened to me when I was 9 years old, and it happened to other kids when they were younger.
So everybody's dealing with gun violence.
I do feel that they
in
are.
One form or another.
Yes.
Does that sound right, Christian? As the principal of the school, are all your students dealing with some version of gun violence, whether it's directly impacting their family or maybe a little more indirect?
I would say, unfortunately, that is absolutely true. I just got word yesterday that one of our students' cousins was just killed by gunshot yesterday morning. So it is everywhere. And we try to put mechanisms in place to support our students and make sure that they're getting the services that they need. And this poetry is an example of another outlet that they can utilize.
How often does the theme of gun violence, Joyce, come up in the poems that your students write?
I think that we are exposed to it. This is our sixth year of participating in Louder Than a Bomb, and it is a topic that comes up every year. So
frequently?
Very frequently.
Yeah. How does the ability of the students to express themselves, as Abby has done so well here today, how does that ability to do that help them cope with something as traumatic as gun violence?
I think it's a start. I think it's an opportunity for students to advocate and to educate. But it's maybe that first step of healing to kind of express the truth. You know, this idea of truth and beauty is kind of intertwined in participating in the poetry, composing it. This is an art. But I think that a lot more needs to be done. We have to recognize that counseling and other resources need to be offered to our students, to the whole community. And I think Brave New Voices recognizes that. Like, we just can't put the trauma on stage without addressing the needs of the poet and the entire community.
That's an interesting idea to me, what Joyce just said, Abby, truth and beauty. It sounds to me like what really draws you to this kind of poetry.
Yeah, it is. And also, I failed to say, but I'm very grateful for it. Any time that I felt like I needed counseling or I needed any type of help, my coaches, my teacher, my principal, they were always there and they're always helping me with resources, and they help every poet and everybody that asks, and even people who don't ask, you know, like, we reach out and we check if they're like, okay, because at the end of the day, composing and performing poetry is only one part, but we like to build a community around it and to remind each other that we're all here for one another.
We're talking in this segment about the success that Lincoln Prep High School has had in a national youth at a National Youth Poetry Festival. Joyce, tell me about the Louder Than a Bomb KC High School Slam Poetry Contest. You were saying that you had to win this thing in order to go down to Houston to compete in this international tournament, and you guys won it.
Correct. It's a movement that really started in Chicago, and Paul Richardson and the American Jazz Museum have made a great effort in making it available to students as far away as Topeka and Lawrence. So there's this huge community of young poets, and I'm hoping that people are excited about it, because I think once you're involved, you just can't quit. And that's what we've discovered about our poetry community at Lincoln, where it was once non-existent. We draw more and more interest, you know, as audience members or as supporters, and then, you know, people who didn't realize they are poets. So we have some reluctant poets who are really professional poets these days.
How often do you come across someone who thinks, I can't do this, and then a month later, they're writing some really great stuff?
I think Abby would say probably every year.
Everybody?
Yeah, I think every poet and every artist doubt themselves. So it's like just becomes a time where you're like, well, I'm not a good poet. But then you have to remember, like, what is good? What is bad? I'm going to break the norms and I'm going to be the best that I can be.
Now, are guys doing this poetry?
Yeah, of course.
On your team, are there more girls or boys?
There is more females, but there was two amazing male poets, and they are such amazing poets, in my opinion.
Joyce, is the team growing every year?
It is growing every year, and we have a fan base, and now I think we have a fan base that is international these days. We're following other poets, and it's just that community is really a family, and we're seeing that they're bringing it to the college campuses. So this is a really exciting movement, because it allows for advocacy and a discussion of some serious topics at the high school level. Middle school kids are even involved in our group.
Christian, all that sounds pretty good, doesn't it? I mean, there's not much to argue with there from a principal standpoint, is there?
Correct. And I would just say that I have personal experience of the benefit of the poetry club and practice
in
and performance.
What way?
My daughter attended Lincoln College Prep, graduated in 2015, and she was a member of the poetry team with Miss Nguyen. And I saw what it did for her. It increased her self-expression and self-confidence to the point that she's actually going to be going to law school after college graduation.
No kidding.
So it's a wonderful thing, and we are so thankful for their effort and talent. It's really amazing.
Abby, how old are you?
I'm 15.
Tell me about self-confidence, because it seems to me like you've got a good amount of it, which is terrific. How did poetry help with that?
Well, yeah, I think I was also, I think being raised in the environment that I was, you're kind of forced to grow up a little bit faster than everybody else who's kind of more privileged. But I have struggled a lot with it, and it's still an everyday thing. I think high school students struggle with self-confidence on a daily basis.
I was going to say, it's pretty common, right?
Yeah, it really is. And but to see women and to see men up on a stage performing and putting their whole body and mind into it, you feel a specific type of way that, like, doing nothing else can make you feel that way. It's kind of like when you meditate. It's like your own zen thing, and it just makes you, your whole body feel amazing.
Would you do one more for us?
Yes, I will.
And what's this one going to be about?
This one is actually about when I went to an open mic, and it kind of tied me back to my roots, and it reminded me of my grandmother and just kind of a religion-based thing.
Okay.
5 months ago, I went to an open mic where they beat the backs of dressing drawers and sang to me in the most righteous language I know. This is the first time I have felt a holy presence in years, and how vile I am for that. Too much trauma lives in the history of those drums for me to feel sanctified, nevertheless holy. They tell the story of when my people was stolen from the motherland and made breakable for the white man's entertainment. How beautifully ironic it is to see them being touched in the spotlight instead of behind closed doors with calloused hands and fearful hearts. The sound is so loud, creating vibrations so strong that it changes the rhythm to my heartbeat, and from that arose the silhouette of my grandmother, reminding me that the word God never had an image attached to it in my mind until we met. I'd never seen skin so golden glow, never smelt the ocean through a person's beach waves before. So to call her kin is to call me holy. I have dreamt of swimming in her smile, and I woke up baptized. This is the woman I imagined behind pearly gates with welcome tattooed on her chest. This is the woman who will whisper my name to the moon and give me the key to the universe. My mother tells me stories like the Bible, and her body is full of scars to prove it. My mother tells me stories like scripture, where my God is her Lucifer pouring boiling hot water down her spine and whipping her naked. This is the woman who crucified her own children and only resurrected them lifetimes later for her own selfish pleading of forgiveness. And on her deathbed, all children wept, for there is no sin greater than hating God. Even though she will leave every wall in your memory scarred, leave this world having snatched more souls than lives she has created. In moments of despair, I find myself with bent knees and trembling hands folded into one another, for I am nothing but a shattered hallelujah screaming to be heard with a broken clock heartbeat, every tick reminding myself that I am impossible to fix, that only her holy hands could mend this disaster. So en el nombre de la Madre, Hijo, y Espíritu Santo. Amen.
That's Abby Espino Salazar. Thank you very much for doing that for us. Congratulations and all your good work at Lincoln Prep. I also want to thank Joyce Fernandez, the coach here, and Christian Foster, the principal at Lincoln Prep. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Keep going.
Thank you.
Best of luck to you all.
Thank you.
Tomorrow is Friday. We're going to sit down with Kay Barnes, the first female mayor of Kansas City. We'll discuss city and county politics, and we'll discuss her work at Park University. Always enjoy having Kay Barnes here. Our show is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, and Kathleen Pointer. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.